Okay, so you can think of this talk as a sequel to Jörn's talk. This one? This one can be more useful. Okay, so I'll talk about the very final stages of planet formation. And I'll try to talk about what happens beyond the stages that Jörn was talking. But let me give you a quick summary of the questions and the answers that Jörn raised and gave. When did oligarchy end? When did the stage that Kokubo and Ida are talking about, where you have equal mass oligarchic all growing together on semicircular orbits and accreting masses of small body, when does it end? What sets the number of final bodies in the solar system? Why do we have only Uranus and Neptune? Why two? Why not seven? Why not one? How long did it take to form them? Was it quick? A million year? 100 million years? Giga year? And why are the orbits circular and coplanar as we see? And the answers were as follows. Okay? Sorry. I did use it. Okay, so oligarchy ends when the surface density of big bodies, capital sigma, is equal to the surface density of the small bodies, basically the total surface density of the system. So when half of the mass is consumed by the big bodies, oligarchy ends. What happens then is that the small bodies are not able to dynamically cool the big bodies by dynamical friction. So the excitation between big bodies simply run away in time, and you get the velocities of the big bodies run away. People did that in some sense, but they forgot in some sense that it starts at that end, at that stage. So the surface density of small bodies is still substantial at the time that Chambers starts its simulations. So even though many people are in love with gas and they want to do gas drag, that's okay. But you should remember that the small bodies are still there, whether you care of them, on them or not, whether you like them or not. They are there once that instability starts. What sets the number of solar system planets? Well, these planets disturb each other, and the disturbances will stop only once you gain stability, once the number of planets have been reduced such that their spacing is large enough that they don't excite each other chaotically. In the inner solar system, they collide because their escape velocity is smaller than the orbital velocity. They can't eject from the solar system. And in the outer solar system, they eject the excess planets. Maybe two or three objects, four objects, were ejected from the Neptune-Uranus region in this model. How long did it take the planets to form? Well, it all depends on the velocity dispersion, as we all know. And the velocity dispersion will get damped if the small bodies are colliding with each other, crushing each other, and damping the velocity dispersion. If the sizes of the small bodies get small enough, the collision rate is so fast, you can do it in basically no time. It's about 100 million years to do the full solar system in the inner solar system, but most of that time is not spent on forming the embryos, the Mars-sized objects, but in forming the final Earth, the final thing before stability kicks in. So the time scale for formation of the Mars-sized object, the isolation masses, can be extremely small if you allow the small bodies to be small. And extremely small, I mean well below a million year in the inner solar system and maybe a million year in the outer solar system. So in the outer solar system, this is the whole story, because you formed Neptune by the end of isolation. And that could be in less than a million years. It's a quick process if you allow the small bodies to collide and dump their velocity dispersion. More time until ejection in the Uranus-Neptune system, it takes about a giga year to get rid of the excess of objects. The orbits get circular and coplanar by their velocity getting dumped on the residual small bodies. And this is something I will spend some time on. This is a preliminary simulation that I did a few weeks ago, but never got a chance to continue with it. So what I started here is with big bodies on circular orbits, and I put the small bodies effectively in an effective dynamical friction. So I don't have really small bodies because I need gazillions of small bodies, and I can't do it. So I just put small bodies in dynamical friction. And when the surface density of small bodies is about 0.25 out of that of big bodies, roughly comparable, maybe a little bit less. You get that the excitation between big bodies can be big enough so the system becomes chaotic. So the stage at which the system loses stability, goes out of the oligarchic phase, is a stage where there is a big mass of small bodies. About a quarter of the mass of the system is still in small bodies.
There's no damping here except collisions, right?
No damping of what?
No damping of the small bodies.
No, the small bodies are assumed to be extremely cold by collisions. Okay? That translates to some assumption on their size. So you can ask which size should they be in order to be that cold as much as I assume. That would be, for this specific simulation, that would be a centimeter size or so. Very small.
What is the surface density of a centimeter size particle? How does that compare with what?
Quarter of a minimum mass solar nebula.
How does that compare with what?
Well, actually,
it's a quarter.
What's that?
You got about a 4 minimum.
Yeah, I need about a few times minimum mass solar nebula, so a quarter of that. It's about a minimum mass solar nebula in small bodies. But they are centimeter size, they're not dust. So they're not as easily observable. Though they're marginally observable.
Well, they're colliding, so they're going to produce
them. Well, if they collide, and I'll get to that, okay? Okay, so the difference between the inner solar system, between Earth and Venus system, and between Uranus and Neptune, is collision in the inner solar system as opposed to ejection in the outer one. But the rest of the story is the same. You start to be unstable once this total mass in big body is equal to that of the small bodies or so, maybe a few times bigger. Then they disturb each other, either collide or eject, and then circularize and get coplanar again due to dynamical friction on small bodies in both cases. What are the implications of the things I told you so far? In the inner planetary region, most of the small bodies get accreted. They can't get ejected, so they must be accreted. We know that they are not here today. And that means that the minimum mass solar nebula is sufficient around here. In the outer solar system, you need something like 5 times the minimum mass solar nebula, because it's hard to... Because first you need to eject the excess of planets you form, and then it's not clear whether or not you can accrete the small bodies, and I'll address that. So if you can't accrete them, you'll need something like 5 times the minimum mass solar nebula. If you can accrete them, maybe only twice. There is some kind of weak prediction here that 3 large bodies, really large, Neptune-sized bodies, were ejected from the solar system. They could be in the Oort cloud if the Oort cloud efficiently captures whatever is being ejected. Yeah, if it's 3% out of 3, probably you won't find them. If the efficiency is higher than that, then maybe they're there. Giant impacts, they happen only in the inner solar system. In the outer solar system, giant ejections, no giant impacts. Okay, so the thing I want to cover now in a little bit more detail is orbital regularization of the orbits. As we said, the eccentricity decays due to interaction with the leftover small bodies. The time scale for that initially is same as the ejection time scale or as the collision time scale. So it's 100 million years in the inner solar system, and it's about a giga year in the outer solar system. And this is the time scale over which we need the small bodies to still be there. What about gas? So gas could have affected the growth rate of planets or embryos at the early stages. That can be. For example, the work by Roman Rafikov used the gas drug to damp the velocity dispersion of the small bodies to enhance the growth rate of the big bodies. We're doing the same, but without gas, collision of the small bodies. But at the end, at the last stages I'm talking about now, you can't rely on gas drug because there is no gas after 100 million years, and certainly not after a giga year. And if there was gas after a giga year, we've seen a gas giant instead of Uranus and Neptune. But we only see these ice giants. Okay, so at the very end stages, there is no gas. It's a clean system. You have small bodies colliding, damping their velocity dispersion, and trying to damp the velocity dispersion of the big bodies. Okay, so the problem that might be relevant is what happens as the velocity dispersion of these Neptune and Uranus in the outer solar system, Earth and Venus in the inner solar system, damps so that the eccentricity, the epicycles they make, are smaller than the separation between them. That's the time that, in principle at least, they can open gaps. We can all take the standard torque formula, these Lindblad resonances that push the disk away on the two sides, and ask how much angular momentum do you need to evacuate in order to open a gap, and estimate the size of a gap as a function of time. The size of a gap you might expect be there as a function of time. And x, the size of the gap over the semi-major axis, can be of order unity within a giga year in the outer solar system or 100 million years in the inner solar system, not so different. The question I want to address first is whether we have clean, sharp gaps or dirty, smooth ones. And could we have accretion through the gaps? So by smooth gaps, I mean something like that. You have two big planets, maybe Uranus and Neptune, and some stuff between them. They each repel the stuff away from them, but there is also diffusion, if you want to think of that, due to collisions between the bodies. The nice thing is that there is a relation between the pushing of the big bodies and the diffusion coefficient. There is no mysterious alpha parameter in here of the disk, because it's all collisions, we can calculate that. And we know the velocity dispersion because it's the same process that pushes the stuff away, which is also exciting the eccentricity. So they're all related, and they come to be into some equilibrium. So the profile between Uranus and Neptune may be something like that, and Uranus and Neptune can accrete from the edges of their Hill sphere a few times, their Hill sphere, 2.5 their Hill sphere, and they can accrete with a lower surface density. If you think of it this way, you'll get that the accretion time is 100 million years, and the diffusion time of objects through between one of them to the other, through collisions and excitations by these big bodies, is about 1 million years. So objects can run around, but it takes them about 100 million years to disappear. The problem with this picture, it might work, but the problem with this picture is that you need some barrier to make sure that the objects will not run away to here or to there. Now there is a barrier in here, these are the giant planets that probably formed earlier. So they may stop any bodies trying to come there with low velocity dispersion, there'll just be a pileup of some bodies in here. But it's not clear if there is anything equivalent to that on the other side. So whether or not it happens depends on that. That's somewhat of a problem. We know from observations that things sometimes form sharp gaps. We've seen that on the rings of many planets. And the story of that is that of negative viscosity, or effectively negative viscosity. And that comes from the fact that when the optical depth of a system becomes so high that two bodies that were excited when they pass near the planet have a coherent phase between them, and they collide while this phase is still coherent, they didn't dephase before collision, the transfer of angular momentum reverses its direction. And angular momentum transfers inward rather than outward. This causes ring to condense rather than disperse. And that's the result of these sharp edges. Okay, so if we have all this nice theory, and it actually seems to be working, are the edges going to be sharp or smooth? Are we going to have this negative viscosity or not? So I already gave you the answer. You need a very high optical depth, or optical depth of order unity, in order to have this negative viscosity. Otherwise, the collision takes so long that these two particles that were coherently excited go dephased before they collide, and you get the standard viscosity. So the answer, whether the gaps are sharp or smooth, is actually both. But I'll get to that later. Depends on the optical depth. What about the eccentricity evolution if the gap is really clean? Let's assume that you have a clean gap, like we think we have in exosolar planets. What happens to the eccentricity? Now, you may know that we have some claims that eccentricity actually grows in the case of exosolar planets, and we believe this is the mechanism that produces this high eccentricity that we observe for the exosolar planets. But we want to use basically the same scenario to damp the eccentricity of the planets in our solar system. So let me try to go through the issues in here quickly. So you have a planet, it has a 1 over r potential around it, the standard 1 over r Newtonian potential, and you can decompose that into Fourier components, cosine m theta with infinite series in m, And if the planet is rotating on a circular orbit, all these Fourier components are going to rotate on a constant pace, which is just the average, the angular velocity of the planet. However, if the planet is on an eccentric orbit, as is seen in this movie, you see it comes in, and on the other side it's farther away. And the angular velocity is therefore not constant. It sometimes goes fast, sometimes goes slow. When you decompose it to all the Fourier components, you find that you need some components which are moving a little bit faster than those and a little bit slower than those. Those components are only there because the planet is eccentric. They are first order in the eccentricity. So these two are first order in eccentricity, and those are zero order in eccentricity. They exist for circular planets. Those are the potential components that are being used in order to open the gap. They are the main ones. They are doing the main pushing in the disk. But it's only those that are responsible to the eccentricity evolution of the planet. It happens to be that even those components are stronger, they take energy and angular momentum in just the right way to keep the eccentricity fixed. So you need something that is rotating in a different speed than the average speed of the planet in order to excite or damp the eccentricity. So that's done by these components. When you try to take to see what happens to those potential components when they interact in the disk with the disk, this is a choice of a specific M, what I've plotted in here, maybe M of 4. So this is the principal component, the one that rotates with the velocity of the disk, doesn't change the eccentricity. And there is a slow component and a fast component. They all have resonances with the disk, three resonances. One, a co-rotation resonance, where the disk co-rotates with the potential component. But that happens to be for these components, outside and inside the planet's orbit. And Lindblad resonances farther away or farther in. And the standard analysis shows that this potential component damps the eccentricity, and this one increases the eccentricity. And when you add them up, you get eccentricity damping at a rate of 4.6 difference between this one and that one. So it's a delicate balance, but in favor of eccentricity damping. Exactly the same way on the other side. And the phenomena we are trying to investigate, in order to say that the eccentricity damps, is the fact that this co-rotation resonance, is that this co-rotation resonance gets saturated. These co-rotation resonances are a very delicate phenomena. They depend on the density gradient of the disk at their position. Only density gradient, not the density itself. So it's enough to make a small tilt in the density gradient at the position of the co-rotation resonance to shut them down. And when this happens, you're only left with those resonances which excite the eccentricity. So we think that is what happening in the extrasolar planet case. And this is also what happens in the disks around, in the planetesimal disk. So in both cases, we think the co-rotation resonances get saturated. The criterion for that is simply that the viscosity will not be high enough, because viscosity will try to smear this back and rebuild the density gradient that was there initially. So we think this is safe. The biggest problem for eccentricity excitation is something raised by Ward and Han, and these are the action of apsidal waves. So if you use the standard torque formula for apsidal waves, you will find that they damp the eccentricity. Not only that they do so, they damp it faster than what all these other resonances are doing by a huge factor, by the orbital velocity over the precession rate, basically. So maybe a factor of 100 stronger than all the others. So even if you say that the other resonances excite the eccentricity because the co-rotation ones damp, you still have to handle this guy. That's a very powerful one. So our claim was that these waves are not, you cannot use for them the standard torque formula, simply. And this is for several reasons. First, these waves do not propagate away in the disk and damp. They have a huge wavelength, and therefore they are trapped in the disk. They form some cavities inside the disk. This is some loops that these waves can do. They are excited in here as a long wave. They come back as a short wave, and they can be reflected from the edge of the disk with a negative value of the wavelength, and repeat this process again. So there is one loop they can do. They can leap, because they are mostly dominated by self-gravity. They can leap from one side of the gap to the other. Maybe I didn't say what the axis is here. This is the distance from the sun. That's the position of the planet. The planet is here, and this is a gap. So the planet actually launches the wave from the edge of the gap. And the fact that these waves are trapped reduces their efficiency, because they only can dump the eccentricity if the waves themselves dump. And that depends on the amount of viscosity. And for the values of alpha we think is there for extrasolar planets, we think that the dumping is going to be small. And if it's going to be small, these waves are going to get excited on the expense of the eccentricity of the planet, but then they're going to stay there, and the eccentricity won't dump anymore.
So,
what's that? Yeah, but they're not non-linear. No, you don't keep feeding energy. Once these waves are coming back, you don't keep feeding them. There's just a standing wave in a disk, which is small, and it stays there, and it only dumps due to viscosity. And since the wavelength is so big, there is no much dumping. Actually, most of the dumping occurs here when the wave is coming back with a shorter wavelength. But even that is not big enough in the extrasolar planet case. It's marginal, though. I'll show the expressions in a second.
But you're talking about gas right now.
What this is, yeah. Well, it's both. Why is it good? It's both. The other effect that reduces the efficiency of these waves below that of the standard torque formula is actually in a gravity case, there is no resonance. The real apsidal resonance happens when the precession rate of the planet is equal to the precession rate of the disk. But let's say in the self-gravity case, the planet is prograde while the disk is retrograding. So there is no exact resonance. But yet you get a similar phenomena at the edge of the gap instead of at a resonance, just slightly reduced. So when you take all the factors that I told you about, and you estimate how much dumping is there in these waves, you get that the ratio of the contribution of the apsidal wave, this very long wavelength phenomena, to that of the standard Lindblad resonances, the ratio between them is something like this. This is the Shakura-Sunyaev viscosity parameter, so you have to guess that for the gas disks, and you can calculate that due to collisions in a particle disk. This is the size of the gap divided by the semi-major axis, and this is the Keplerian velocity over the velocity dispersion in the disk or the sound speed if it's a gas disk. And what we found is that this value is about 0.1 for the gaseous disks, the extrasolar planet case, and therefore the apsidal wave is not going to be crucial. It's not small, but it's sort of marginal, but it reasonably can be unimportant. It can reasonably be thought to be unimportant. Yet in the planetesimal disk case, because the velocity dispersion can be so low, again, because of the damping of the velocity due to collisions of the small bodies, you can have this factor huge, and if you just use this equation as is, it will tell you that the ratio between the apsidal wave to the standard one is 10 to the 5. When you get 10 to the 5, it overestimates because it's even more than the standard torque formula. It means that this wave actually dumped, and the result is going to be something close to the standard torque formula. A little bit less because you are exciting the wave outside of resonance. But it's going to be a big factor. So we think what damps the eccentricity of these planets inside these gaps is this apsidal wave. The same one which is sort of a problem for extrasolar planets, but still okay.
What about land darkening?
What's that?
Land down damping.
Land down damping. We'll have
land
down. Nothing to do with this.
Take as far afield.
Okay. So how do you clean up the disk? So we think the disk is efficient in damping the eccentricity, whether there is a clean gap or not. But how do you clean up the disk? First question you want to ask is, why do you need to clean up the disk? Maybe just leave it there. There are tight limits on the amount of mass in the solar system, left in whatever you want, not in planets. You can do that from the orbits of the planets themselves in the inner solar system. And it turns out the best limits in the outer solar system come from observations of the comet Halley. It did a transition here at 1910 and another one at 86. And you can calculate the precession rate that comet had and put an upper limit on the mass of on residual mass in the solar system. And it's less than Earth, 10 Earth masses at 100 AU. And since it's only the quadrupole moment that comes into effect, then if you want to put it closer, you can put even less. You can put more mass farther away. So it's a really strict limit. If you think of the Neptune region at 30 AU, you can have only a fraction of an Earth mass left there. You really have to clean it up. Okay, so if all bodies are very small, gaps are very clean. There is no accretion, there is no ejection, and you cannot form the Oort cloud. So it's, we seem to arrive to a contradiction here. What size is small? Well, you need to look at the size that allows the particles. There are two effective sizes. One is S cross and one is S eject. S cross is the size of a particle that can get excited from the planet, let's say Neptune. So this is the size of a particle that can get excited from Neptune and reach Neptune. The eccentricity can be so high that it can bridge the gap and arrive to Neptune without suffering a collision before, a significant collision, meaning without colliding with a mass comparable to its own before. And that turns out to be a kilometer size in the Neptune region. If you want to eject objects, if you want Neptune itself, no other planets, if you want Neptune itself to be able to eject planet, you need that guide not to suffer a collision for a giga-year, because this is the time scale that takes Neptune to eject a planet. And if you want to know not to suffer a collision over a giga-year, you need to be a size of 100 kilometers. So if the particles are small, they can't do that. If they're smaller than a kilometer, they can't even arrive to Neptune. They certainly cannot be ejected. This is some sketch of some ideas people have about the formation of the Oort cloud. This is very similar to some diagram that Duncan showed earlier. This is the time scale that it takes to excite things. So if things have small eccentricity, you can excite them over a very short time scale. And it's proportional to their eccentricity to the fourth. The longest time scale, it takes just to double the semi-major axis of the particles you're trying to scatter. Then scatterings become faster and faster, because even though the orbital period of that test particle is proportional to the semi-major axis of the 3/2, the number of interactions you need in order to eject it is proportional to 8^-2. So overall, it becomes faster and faster to get ejection. At very distant places, where you need just a single kick to be ejected, there is only the duration of the orbit that comes in, and it goes like 8^3. So if you want to form objects in the Oort cloud, you need to spend a lot of time for them to first get excited to an eccentricity of order unity. That was this value of S eject that I calculated in here. So you need to be 100 kilometers if you want to do that with Neptune in order to just cross that barrier. Where is that? The other way. If you want to cross that barrier, you need to be 100 kilometers in size if you're using Neptune. But the time scale for ejection is strongly dependent on the mass of the planet. The giga-year, this number, giga-year, came if you wanted to use the mass of Neptune. But if instead you want to do that with Jupiter, you can do that way more easily. It takes only 10^5. So smaller objects can get ejected from Jupiter. And you can get out with kilometer-sized objects getting ejected from Jupiter. So the idea here is that kilometer-sized objects can just cross Neptune. They cannot get all the way to ejection, because crossing Neptune only needs a small eccentricity, because the gaps are not so huge. The distance between Neptune and Uranus is small. So small eccentricity is enough to arrive to Neptune. And then it can hop from Neptune to Uranus, to Saturn, to Jupiter, and get kicked on a short time scale where it doesn't have collisions. So if you have so much mass in the outer solar system, there is no way we can eject it directly from Neptune. We must use Jupiter if we want to eject kilometer-sized bodies.
How do you explain the scatter disk?
I don't know about the scatter disk. The scatter disk for now.
If it's so much faster just to hand it off, why does it matter? I mean, how would it be ejected by Neptune anyway?
Yeah, it won't. If all the planets are there, we think that the general process is that they're being handed to Jupiter and then get ejected. But it says something, because Jupiter is a very powerful kicker. And that maximal semi-major axis that it can kick is about 1,000 times or 100 times its own semi-major axis. So it's about 1,000 AU. And you need very strong galactic tides that will be able to save something at that semi-major axis. Otherwise, if you rely on higher semi-major axes, they only come by an accident. And the number there that will come to that semi-major axis is proportional to 1/semi-major axis, just the energy bin corresponding to that semi-major axis. So when you're using Jupiter, you may have efficiency problems. Okay, so now we have two sizes, this kilometer size and this 100 kilometer size, and we want to see what's reasonable. to be consistent with what I told you so far, I need actually disks of small bodies. Small bodies are going to collide and crush each other. And instead, to clean it up, I need actually big bodies. Then you can come back to gravitational instability. Well, this was already discussed today by Yoding, but we don't have all that complicated scenario because we're doing that so late, there is no gas. All we have is a particle disk which collides and dumps the velocity dispersion. It's going to become unstable. There is no much question about that. And there are two sizes that are associated with the gravitational instability. One is the maximally unstable wavelength. So there is a maximally unstable wavelength. If you allow all that mass to collapse to a solid body of normal densities, you get that its size is about 100 kilometers at several at the outer solar systems.
Are you assuming a minimum mass is still left?
Yeah, something like a minimum mass, because I started with a little bit more of a minimum mass, and I ejected half of it, and the other half is still in small bodies. So something like
solid.
There is no gas.
No, but the total, when you say minimum mass, are you talking about the value of the solid?
Yeah, of course. Okay, so you can, in principle, form 100 kilometer-sized bodies. But there is, as you know, in the gold-like Warren's instability, which is basically this, there are two stages. A quick collapse, which is dictated by the maximal size in the disk, which you can collapse into a solid object without losing angular momentum. That gives you a much smaller object. It gives you objects of size 2 kilometers in the outer solar system, with the sigma a little bit bigger than the minimum mass of an angular. So its size of 2 kilometers, those are the objects that form very quickly, in a quick collapse, without losing angular momentum. And all you need to rely there is on collisions, which are going to be very frequent because we had tiny bodies. So these tiny bodies, they cool themselves, they become unstable, and they form 2 kilometer-sized objects. The problem is that these 2 kilometer-sized objects, they begin to scatter each other. And without the help of some gas to lose angular momentum, the most unstable object, which in principle contains many, many of these objects, is going to be scattered. And what you can show is that the escape velocity out of that cluster is just equal to the escape velocity of these bodies. So they scatter each other, and they scatter the whole cluster away. So my guess is that it's going to be hard, maybe not impossible, but it's going to be hard to make the second stage. And it's going to be pretty easy to make that stage. But this is all we need in order to form these big bodies in the outer solar system, fans of them to Neptune, Uranus, inner woods, and eject them by Jupiter.
Graham, are you worried about the initial size of small particles or you form the gravitational stability?
Yes.
It doesn't matter.
It's this slide what you're asking, I think. So what are the size of bodies? Given the fact that Uranus and Neptune are there and they are trying to excite the velocity dispersion of the system, what size of small bodies will provide enough dissipation so the disk will become unstable? So they have to be the velocity that stabilizes the disk, the velocity dispersion that stabilizes such a disk, is just 2 meters per second in the outer solar system. And the size of small bodies that will have enough collisions to dump the velocity dispersion below 2 meters per second is about a centimeter. So the story is simple. You'll have bodies in the outer solar system of whatever size. They collide, crash, the velocity dispersion goes down until it becomes unstable. And that gives you, that happens when they are at a centimeter size, and that is associated with what you asked.
Since they're colliding, it's
okay, so at this, no, collisions can happen before the optical depth is one. Even when low optical depth, it just takes several orbital periods. But you can calculate, given the surface density that I have and the size of the small bodies, you can calculate what the optical depth is, and it's marginal, it's around unity. So that's why I don't know if the small bodies really form sharp edges or smooth disks. So in the outer solar system, it's giga-years.
Giga-years, not min. Are there any system that has this extended disk, you know, at 1 giga-year, that still have this kind of massive disk?
And the question is, how thick is the disk?
Yeah, this disk is going to be extremely thin.
Well, except that Uranus and Neptune both have slight inclinations.
Well, we don't know when these inclinations came. At this time, well, I don't know. They interacted with Jupiter and Saturn. This dumps everything very quickly. The problem you're going to have with this model is that you're going to have zero eccentricity and zero inclination. You'll have to, something else we'll need to... Yeah, so maybe there'll be some bending wave.
No, but so the problem then is that even if the optical depth is 10 to minus 4.
No, this the optical depth here is not going to be 10 to the minus 4.
No, it's a border unity, but you only catch 10 to the minus 4.
That's right. Right.
But then you re-radiate it.
Right. Despite it's going to be hard to detect. With the current instrument,
no, 10 to the minus 4 is easy. I mean,
no, it's not.
It's only 10 to the minus 3. And that thing's like, boom.
Okay, let's see. These are, that's a 30 AU. The difference from the standard stuff, these are centimeter sized bodies. It's not dust particles. The temperature is going to be therefore different because the emissivity is different, right? These are going to be, it's going to be higher and in different frequencies. We looked at that, and our understanding was that it won't be detectable. Now, if the answer is different, that's going to be a test of this model, okay? And I think that with new generation of instruments, it's going to be detectable. So if you want, it's a prediction. So I'm going to have several predictions in here. This is one of them, okay? These disks are marginally detectable, not only in the outer solar system, maybe even worse in the inner solar system, okay? So both should be detectable when the, as Lynn is promising us, all this field is going to improve. So these disks are marginal now. They're going to get detectable soon. Okay, summary. Oligarchy ends when sigma equals sigma. Whether you want it or not, the small bodies cannot cool the big bodies. And therefore, at the end stages, you will have these small bodies there. And it takes time to get rid of them. So that's a consequence of our model, but I don't see any way around it. With the small bodies, the last stages of isolation, the formation of Uranus and Neptune, can be extremely fast, because they dump their velocity dispersion and accretion is enhanced by gravitational focusing extremely. So there can be a fraction of a million years, even for Uranus and Neptune, the last stages of formation. And it could be even faster for the Earth. Ejection in the outer solar system, collisions in the inner solar system. Then after the ejection, the orbits get regularized by the small bodies again. Regularization works also in clean gaps, unlike the case for extrasolar planets, where the eccentricity is likely to get excited by the saturation of the core rotation resonance and the ineffectiveness of the apsidal wave. It's difficult to get rid of the small bodies. I don't think I gave a completely clear picture, but I gave some ideas. Instabilities in the disk form kilometer-sized bodies. They go through the planets and get ejected by Jupiter. Gravitational instability is a key player on these late stages to form the kilometer-sized bodies. It sets minimum to the velocity dispersion, because as soon as the velocity dispersion falls below 2 meters per second, it becomes unstable. And it may set the size of the particles again, because when the particles become less than a centimeter, they dump the velocity so effectively that makes the system unstable, and the whole system is being steered. Most likely ejection is by Jupiter. You cannot form the Oort cloud directly out of the Uranus-Neptune region. And the reason is that collisions for 1 kilometer-sized bodies are too frequent. And you can't, if you're trying to eject something from just using Uranus-Neptune, you will experience a collision before ejection. You must use a more powerful kicker, and it may mean that you need a more dense environment so the tides can save it, even though the perturber is that powerful.
But if you do that, you end up with a massive inner Oort cloud.
Yeah, that's made it true.
But you don't put enough mass in the outer Oort cloud.
Not immediately, yeah. That's right. I read these reasons. And there is another prediction that I'm making here. If all this story is correct, it's unlikely to have sub-kilometer bodies in the Oort cloud. So probably now we don't see them even if they're there because the detections are not so easy. But I'm giving here a prediction, and I can tell you how much mass will be in each size bin. Because as you deplete the surface area around Uranus and Neptune, you can have smaller and smaller bodies being escape from the system without collisions. But while you have the full minimum mass solar nebula, or a few times the minimum mass solar nebula, only kilometer-sized bodies and higher can escape. And as you deplete it, smaller bodies can escape, but then the total mass is smaller. So there is a prediction here that the total mass in smaller bodies in the Oort cloud is going to diminish with the size of the objects. I try to look what is known about this, and there are not many estimates for the sizes of these things, and they vary, but they are about a few kilometers, maybe 8 kilometers is a median for the sizes of objects in the old cloud beam. Thank you.
I actually have a couple of comments. If presumably the material in the outer solar system, which you're making everything out of, is dirty snowballs, i.e. comet-type material, then when you're grinding things down to centimeters, you're going to create a hell of a lot of dust, I would think, inevitably, just because they're just dirty snowballs anyway. And I would think that would show up in observations quite easily.
So, what's that? So this dust, if you'll have a significant amount of dust, it will dump its velocity, only the dust will dump the velocity dispersion even faster, and that will reform bigger objects. This is some repetition of this cycle of gravitational instability, preventing you from having too much mass in very small bodies.
And my other comment about the apsidal waves, I know Martin Duncan, a student, have tried to simulate apsidal waves in the Kuiper belt where collisions were ignored and had some trouble, because the forced eccentricities were being confused by the free eccentricities, and never got a coherent wave as far as I know. But the one example where we know apsidal waves exist is Saturn's rings, where the collisions keep the free eccentricities down and you do get coherent responses. So have you thought about what the collision frequency has to be to get nice coherent apsidal waves?
Well, the collision frequency, is calculated in here. Well, I care of, in order to dump these waves. Where was that thing? Yeah, so the collision frequency basically sets the velocity dispersion of the particles. And it's that equation that gives you the overall importance of the apsidal wave in dumping the eccentricity. Yeah, so that's basically it, yeah. So the collisions are included in here. And what this calculation shows is that in this planetesimal disks, if the particles are as small as we are saying, you're gonna have this wave dumped, and therefore the eccentricity dumped. In the exosolar planet case, no, it's going to stay there. And there's going to be a standing wave there, exchanging energy and angular momentum backward and forward with the planet. And the eccentricity is not going to be affected, only on the dumping scale of that apsidal wave, which is long.
If the eccentricities are indeed excited in extrasolar planet systems, we have a problem with GJ876 because we need eccentricity damping there to account for the low eccentricities that we see in those resonances. And I was wondering, you know, in extrasolar planetary disk, as I understand what you said here, that a planetesimal disk will in fact damp the eccentricity outside of ways. Gaseous disks do the other thing.
Right.
But there will be planetesimals in extrasolar planetary disks.
Not absolutely clear.
And in other words, can one construe a situation where you would have planetesimal disks damping the eccentricity in extrasolar planetary systems?
Well, if they're big enough, then the velocity dispersion is going to be high, and I'm going to reduce this number. But in this scenario, it's not going to happen. When the particles are small enough, then planetesimal disks are going to damp. The question you ask about the damping and excitation of eccentricity is a general problem regardless of this model. Our solar system doesn't have eccentric Jupiter.
Yes.
And what we see in the exosolar planets are. Maybe some answer is that this is indeed marginal. It depends on many things we don't know. It depends on the alpha Shakura Sunyaev of this disk. We don't know where it's coming from. We don't know if it at all exists. We don't know the temperature of these gases and the scale height. We don't know the sizes of the gaps. Depends again on the viscosity. So all these things, there is some conspiration here, which ended up our best estimate to be 0.1. Now, in some cases, it can be lower. Some cases, it can be higher. The saturation of core rotation resonance is a little safer, I would say. But this is sort of the biggest problem. So if that, in some cases, become comparable to 1, you'll get eccentricity dumping. And that's a marginal quantity.
In fact, the numerical simulations that we saw earlier in the week do get eccentricity damping in type 2 drift, albeit not sufficient to account for the eccentricities we see in GJ876. Now, there may be ways to increase that eccentricity damping.
So the simulations should not get this, because we think that's not very important. But the core rotation resonance saturation is a very, very delicate thing, this thing. The region over which you have to flatten the density gradient of the disk is extremely narrow. This is the libration width of the co-rotation resonance. And it's so narrow that you need to have many, many radial divisions in order to resolve it. What I think we need in the subject, and really to understand whether this happens or not, is some targeted simulations, which are just trying to get exactly that effect, other than putting a full planet and see if the eccentricity dumps or increases. I'm trying to convince some people to work on this, so maybe we'll know.
So if Uranus and Neptune are oligarchs, then they get their obliquities by something later, maybe some spin orbit residence that Bill will still yet discover. But what about their rotational days? How do you get the 17-hour day of Uranus?
17-hour day? I don't know. The collisions themselves, okay. So we think that collisions, giant collisions, did not happen in the outer solar system, right? So it's not going to be by collisions. And actually, accretion of small bodies seems to be inefficient. There are some in exciting the spin. So I don't know the answer to your question. There are some papers that are trying to just calculate the number of small objects coming from this side and that side and spinning differently. What's that?
I know those papers.
You know those papers? Yeah. Okay. I'm not sure they give the final... The result in those papers is a very small spin. And I'm not sure that the answer there is correct. I understand where it's coming from, but it has to do with how bodies are coming again when they basically are doing horseshoe orbits and come from the other sides, and all that is ignored in those papers. They assume that the disk coming to the planet is unperturbed. So I don't know what the true answer to that question. But so far, I don't have an explanation for the spin.
You use the apsidal wave damping, in the end to keep the eccentricity is growing,
right.
But you didn't refer to it earlier. And I mean, wouldn't this be operating even at an earlier point? I mean, is this included when you talk about when oligarchy breaks down?
Okay,
you're using dynamical friction rather than.
Okay, so Paul, where is Paul? Where's Paul? Paul is going to tell you that if you have no gaps, you have the co-orbital Lindblad resonances, and they are more powerful than any of this, and they will damp the eccentricity. So all these games become relevant when you have clean gaps, as in this situation. So while these oligarchs are still there, there are no clean gaps because the separation between the oligarch is just a few times the Hill sphere, and these test particles are running all over. So you can only have gaps when the separation between the planet is several times the Hill sphere, many times the Hill sphere. So that's only after the ejection or collision in the inner solar system and the initial damping of the eccentricity by standard dynamical friction. And then when you have planets in gaps, this kicks in.
Did you have a question?
A few things about the eccentricity growth or damping and for the extrasolar planets. Concerning this, you mentioned the possibility of numerically testing the co-rotation separation.
Right.
So those calculations have been done by Frédéric Marseille, actually. So it hasn't been written up yet, but it confirms the analytical right.
Thank you.
The other thing is that concerning the apsidal waves, I mean, I think actually the wavelength is so long that the resonant standard resonant torque formula not only has to be modified, I would say it's completely inapplicable. So really you have to do a global mode calculation.
That's
or not even a mode calculation, but a global calculation of the eccentricity profile.
That's completely right. We haven't done that. What we have is order of magnitude estimates of all of the relevant effects.
Yes.
I can count them for you. So first is the fact that the wavelength is very long. And the standard torque formula assumes that the forcing is constant over more than one wavelength, which is obviously not the case. So that reduces the driving by the ratio of the forcing distance, the distance over which the forcing is constant, to the first wavelength. So we took that into account. Then we took into account the fact that these waves are trapped in the disk and they are not propagating. And we took only the damping due to whatever viscosity, some mysterious alpha viscosity in gaseous disk or collisions in these disks. Those are all the factors we put in. So it takes into account that the standard torque formula is inapplicable in these situations. We corrected for that in an order of magnitude way, so we don't have an exact result. So that 0.1 I cited there I hope it's close to that. But factors of two, I can believe easily.
If I understand your pictures about gravitational instability plus this rock grinding down, so you need to be going on this process again and again and again.
Yes.
But particles grinding down is fastest at the lowest end, right?
Right. But so is
that means.
But so is the formation of kilometer-sized bodies as soon as it becomes unstable.
Exactly.
So
that
these
means,
two processes are very fast. So they ground, few bodies are formed again.
Exactly. So that's the problem. I don't understand. That means during this whole cycle, most of the time, particles is in big rocks, not in little dust, not in little particles, which you use to damp your eccentricity.
Well, it's not clear. It can be simultaneously happening. So it's not all the disk is altogether unstable. This unstable wavelength is not the whole size of the disk. So you can have something happening in here, something else happening in here. It's a complicated system. It's a very interesting system. I think it's a great problem to actually analyze what's going on in here in detail and how do you get that equilibrium between the big bodies and small bodies. To answer your question, what's the mass, total mass in kilometer-sized bodies compared to the total mass in centimeter-sized bodies, the unstable one? I don't know the answer to
that. But because of that cascade timescale difference, it means most of the mass at any given time will be in large rocks.
No. Why does it mean that?
Because it takes the longest to cascade down at that scale.
Well, as soon as you have some of the kilometer-sized bodies collide, they don't all collide at the same time, you begin to fill out this cascade. Now, exactly where you stop depends on how much mass you put in there. I said you stop at a centimeter size. This assumes that most of the mass is at small bodies. But if there are less of the masses in small bodies, they're going to cascade even further down, and they become unstable even with a smaller surface density. And then they form smaller bodies because there's less surface density. So there'll be some complicated scenario there, which I can't analyze. Well, maybe I can, but I didn't analyze so far. And it's an interesting problem. I don't know the answer to that ratio.
Well, I'm afraid that your solar system doesn't look very much like our own because, well, you say you form the cores of Uranus and Neptune very quickly, in less than a million years.
I said the last stages take less than a million years.
So
the
there
initial
is a problem
stages,
why they didn't accrete gas.
Yeah,
but in particular, I'm concerned.
Okay, I'm answering this. The initial stages may take longer.
Okay.
So if you assume that there was some gravitational instability in the beginning, or you start with kilometer-sized planetesimals, then the first few stages are just simply collision stages of these 1-kilometer-sized bodies. That takes about 20 million years. Then you begin to grow bigger and bigger bodies, and the process becomes faster and faster because some of the bodies grew, some of the bodies crushed to dust and dumped the velocity dispersion. The last stage, the last doubling of the mass, takes less than a million years.
Yeah, but I'm particularly concerned by the planetesimals because you live in this world of 1 centimeter planetesimals, which eventually by gravitational instability produce a few kilometer bodies.
Right.
But we know 100,000 bodies bigger than 100 kilometers in the Kuiper Belt. The size distribution ranges up to Pluto. There were probably hundreds of Pluto initially.
Right.
And this, well, you could say it's farther out, but Neptune has a Trojan, which is big. Neptune and Uranus have irregular satellites, which are not a few kilometers in size, but several tens of kilometers in size.
And I don't know that there have been 100
Plutos. You have to form a scatter disk because you observe it.
Okay, so the Kuiper Belt is maybe a similar story, somewhat outward to what I'm talking about. So if you want to examine what happened in the Kuiper Belt region, I think the standard view is that there was a comparable mass there too, some extrapolation of the minimum mass solar nebula, and bodies begin to form there, and something stopped the process by some scattering. Maybe one of these big bodies scattered from the Uranus-Neptune region, disturbed it, I don't know what. But it was a system in the process of runaway accretion that didn't reach the end. So it never reached the end of oligarchy, and it stopped there. So the Kuiper Belt may be simply a young object-forming system that got disrupted in the first few tens of million years of its lifetime.
Yeah, the Trojan asteroids, for instance, for Jupiter,
Trojan's
or the Trojan of Neptune, they are where the planets are. The irregular satellites are where the planets are. So
right.
It's not just big stuff in the Kuiper Belt. There was presumably big stuff also in the planetary region.
Right, well, that is associated maybe with the formation of Jupiter and Saturn, which we didn't discuss, maybe there were many big bodies there that got into the Trojans. It's a different story, I don't know. Roman is waiting for a very long time.
I have a question about this gravitational stability. You said that your unstable wavelengths for q equals 1 is like 100 kilometers or something.
Yes.
I mean the size of the body which will be collected.
Right. From the maximally unstable wavelength. This is the
Right. Okay. So you are claiming that you can destabilize much smaller wavelengths, which would require dropping q from unity to much smaller values, right?
Yeah, that's right.
But
not from the beginning. So if you want some details of this process, these are just thoughts. It's not well worked out. If you just make q just marginally 1. There are papers by Gami doing that for...
This is my point. I mean, would you be worried about this, your cooling time of these particles being actually equal to your orbital period?
Yes.
And that it will produce quite a lot of gravitational turbulence, which will tend, you know, to disallow your fragmentation into clumps. I mean, it will just tend you to keep in this filamentary structure and not allowing gravitational stability to proceed and, you know, drop your q below...
Good point. Let me explain what the issue is. So Oman is worried that as you are cooling these disks, you reach marginal instability, q just equal to 1, and then the disk will become unstable. It just tries to form these 100 kilometer sized bodies. These are the most unstable wavelength and the only unstable wavelength when q is just 1. And the disk will just steer itself up to keep q equal 1 without allowing anything to further collapse. Okay, and simulations by Gami shows that the issue whether that happens or not depends on the cooling time scale as compared to the orbital velocity. So if you cool quickly compared to the orbital velocity, that's not the case. You get cooled very, very quickly. You form, you begin to collapse this most unstable wavelength, and inside of it you can collapse smaller and smaller objects. Okay, you don't have the whole disk to get cooled. You can just be marginally unstable, collapse big sizes, and within them start to collapse smaller and smaller things. Okay? You just need collisions. You don't need any loss of angular momentum to form these kilometer-sized bodies. This is the beauty of this kilometer-sized body.
Yeah, you understand.
And the size of bodies that we found that needs... where is that? The size of bodies we need in order to get... to get the instability, the size of small bodies for stability is about half a centimeter. And with that size of bodies, the optical depth is just one or just a few, actually. Few means that the collision time scale is faster than the orbital velocity. So you are in this regime that you are forming.
Well, it's marginally faster.
Marginally, yeah.
And you're talking about lowering Q from unity to like 10 to the minus 3 or something, which you would need to to go.
Yeah, but it will go all the way. So once you start it, these objects are forming, the thing will continue, and as you create smaller bodies within those collapsing objects, it will just go faster and faster. So I think it's okay. Once it starts, it's okay, unless it starts very, very gently.
Okay.
This was it.
Good.
Probably about the last question if you want to eat dinner that's not cold.
How do you avoid doing this in the asteroid belt, which is currently hot and which doesn't have a lot of bodies which are sampled as meteorites, which are combinations of ground up, differentiated and undifferentiated?
So
objects.
My guess, I'm not sure, I didn't think of that enough, but my guess is that the asteroid belt has something to do with Jupiter. So Jupiter played a key role there, formed earlier. Well, that's a standard answer, right? Everybody believes that. And also I want to point that this was really effective. We kept Hal quiet during the whole question session.